Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. How do we confront or reckon with our nation's violent history? It's a question that we have asked on this show before. I mean, do we remove Confederate statues? Do we rename college buildings and mascots? How do we live with these remembrances of our complex heritage? Well, this is something that historian Christine DeLucia has thought a lot about. She studies indigenous communities, and in particular, she's looked at how King Philip's War, also known as the First Indian War, shaped New England's identity. Now, for those of us who need a refresher, the 17th century war was one of the deadliest conflicts in American history. Fought between New England settlers and native peoples of New England, it destroyed about half the colonist towns and killed and dispersed thousands of native inhabitants. The war is named for Wampanoag leader King Philip, Metacom, who, depending on the writer, led the attack or the resistance. And in her new book, Memory Lands, King Philip's War and the Place of Violence in the Northeast, DeLucia delves into how the war has been remembered, marginalized, forgotten, or suppressed from the perspective of indigenous communities. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I was wondering if you could just sort of give us a little refresher course to set the stage here. I mean, the war began in 1675. I mean, what immediately preceded it that led to this violence?
Sure. When violence breaks out in 1675, it's coming out of long building tensions in this region. And before briefly outlining those, I would mention that Boston is at the heart of this. Mm-hmm. Boston being in the middle of Massachusetts, Wampanoag, Nipmuc, homelands connected to all these places, and I would certainly recognize the tribal communities who are still in this area. Their ancestors are experiencing enormous stresses over the course of the 17th century, which begin in some ways in 1620 when the Pilgrims show up in Patuxet, which they call Plymouth, and escalate in the generations after that. Among the tensions that are creating difficulties for Native communities is land loss. Mm-hmm. I would put that at the top of the list, that communities, Native communities, are experiencing difficulties in holding on to their land bases because colonists are trying to sometimes defraud them from land, sometimes purchase land, and it's really breaking up the traditional places where they would fish and hunt and plant and creating just enormous tensions. Another factor that is leading to this is unbalanced trade relationships,
yeah.
Right? So English colonizers are trying to trade for beaver, pelts, and other goods from Native communities. And very quickly, these relationships go awry or become very asymmetrical and unbalanced. So Native people are falling into debt and experiencing pressure to sell land.
I know that there are more things that lead to this moment in the continent's history, but I want to get to your deeper points, which is like how that history is viewed by indigenous peoples, by mm-hmm. Native peoples. But before we do that, you know, I called it the most violent conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do we measure the scale of the violence that was met upon indigenous peoples and on the colonists?
Scholars and communities have attempted to figure out proportionally how many people, both natives and colonists, perish as a consequence of this. And the numbers are disputed, but it is enormously destructive. Something I would stress is that native communities prior to this war had already experienced epidemic disease at a catastrophic scale, which for some coastal communities meant maybe something like 90% population loss. So it's important to keep that in mind when thinking about the accumulation of losses that communities experience once warfare begins to spiral out of control. Right. This is on top of already losing integral community members. And in addition, it is causing the displacement of survivors from their traditional lands. Mm. Not all of them, but those who managed to live through the war are finding it increasingly difficult to maintain a foothold in their homelands.
Yeah. You know, so one thing that you write, one of the many important things that you write about is, and this I would say this is common in how we look back on colonial history, mm-hmm. I should say, that much of how we remember it is driven by those who left the written histories, mm-hmm. right? And in most narratives from this particular war, you write, are, quote, colonial ancestor worship that valorized the conquests of natives during King Philip's War, even as they dutifully lamented the scale of the destruction, meaning that mm-hmm. the records that were left behind by one side.
To a large extent, yes, although something that I stress in the book and that scholars who work in Native studies have been increasingly paying attention to is that Native people have been writing.
Yeah.
They have been creating memorials. They have been enacting ceremony in ample ways over several centuries. And it's not that these are hidden archives necessarily, but that it depends on the vantage of who's looking for information. And so I gesture at in the book a number of tribal magazines, tribal produced histories that are actually very much out there. You can find them, you know, freely downloadable, and they present strong alternate perspectives on this conflict. But you're right that there's a bit of an imbalance in terms of who is producing the volume of seemingly authoritative history. And indigenous understandings have been very powerful within communities, but not always legible to Euro-Americans or colonial descendants outside those communities.
Okay, so tell us more about that, because you travel to many places mm-hmm. in the process of writing this book, and you talk about how a part of the story that we also don't fully recognize is how memory is bound up with these places, mm-hmm. right? Like you say that you were climbing mountains, mucking through swamps, sliding across frozen streams, enduring island ferries with seasick tourists, paddling canoes, bushwhacking through overgrown colonial cemeteries. I mean, what's significant about these places which we aren't currently recognizing?
Mm-hmm. I thought that it was essential to go into, in a deep and careful way, the actual places, the very seemingly minor landscapes where these events of violence had transpired in the 1670s. And most academic scholars, not tribal communities, but most academic scholars have preferred to work in a fairly small subset of libraries. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, I realized back when I began working on this project in college, they were missing so much of the story that resides in small towns, in tribal communities' own collections. And those stories often challenge the dominant narrative.
Well, so then tell us about one specifically. You went to Great Swamp near Narragansett Bay. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Great Swamp is a site that Narragansetts today treat with great sensitivity and care. Many of their ancestors, most likely hundreds of them, were surrounded and attacked there in the winter of 1675 by colonial troops who managed to infiltrate a palisade, a sort of protected village that Narragansetts had constructed as a refuge in the heart of the swamp. And I talk in a number of ways about the significance of Great Swamp, because the signage there that has been put up by colonial descendants speaks of this place as the site where the Narragansetts were destroyed, giving the sense of the last of the Narragansetts. There are no more.
Hmm.
And that notion of the finality of indigenous presence, but also sovereignty, political power, right? When you have a memorial that claims that, it makes it very difficult for surviving indigenous descendants, the Narragansett tribe
yeah.
today, to assert their own autonomy.
Well, I mean, you have an example of that, yeah. right? That you spoke to an elder, Don Dove. A Narragansett elder? Do I have that right?
I have cited her work.
You
yes.
cited her work.
She's a writer in her own right.
Okay,
actually.
Okay. Yes. But what you talk about mm-hmm. is that in grade school she was reading mm-hmm. these stories about how all the Narragansett were destroyed or mm-hmm. killed during the war, but yet she mm-hmm. she's a member. She's a Narragansett.
Oh yes,
there she was.
Yes,
herself.
And these histories have been maintained and stewarded and protected within tribal communities for so many generations. But the textbooks that many young people across New England and the United States, the accounts in those of this war present the end of indigenous presence, or nearly so, in New England. And this creates real difficulties today as tribes are attempting to exercise sovereignty and in some cases regain traditional homelands. For the Narragansetts today, Great Swamp is not part of their formal tribal reservation. And there's a long history to that. And that is something that I want to bring to light through this book, how contestations over memory are very much about place
mm-hmm.
and who claims authority over that place and caretaking over that place.
Mm. So there's another one, Deer Island, mm-hmm. that you went to. People probably know it for entirely different reasons now. Mm-hmm. But what was significant about Deer Island in your research?
Deer Island, I often mention to people who've never heard of this conflict, because if they have ever flown into Logan Airport, they have seen these giant digester eggs, so-called.
Yeah. So because a wastewater treatment facility.
It is. Right. And there was a long debate in the 1990s about the construction of a sewage facility on a site that Native communities consider intensely sensitive, because for their ancestors, Deer Island was where colonists confined them, incarcerated them during King Philip's War, ostensibly for their own protection. But the effect of this was death and high degree of loss for Native people left on this cold, windswept island over the winter with very little provisions at hand. And over the years, survivors of those who managed to make it off the island, descendants of those survivors, have lobbied to have a memorial created that talks about this history, and have also engaged in gatherings, ceremonies, a canoe journey over the past number of years, in order to insist that there are other histories here.
How have those lobbying efforts gone?
They have been mixed, and one thing that I appreciated, or rather saw through alternate vantages, when I took a tour of the sewage treatment plant, I really wanted to understand why that came to be there. And I understand now that there are some really complex environmental management challenges around Boston. The sewage plant probably could have been located elsewhere, but there are reasons why it came to be there. And communities have had a challenging time finding a foothold kind of amid that really contested site. But I will say that the MWRA, who oversees it, has in the past number of years supported and welcomed tribal community members who are engaging in a memorial on that island. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
And there are these relationships that have developed.
So I want to talk with you for a little bit about the importance of us as New England as a region, mm-hmm. And as a community of neighbors to grappling with this now. Mm-hmm. Because in the book you write about how New England is still, in your words, invested in a strong self-image of historical innocence. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about what you mean about that.
Right. I write that as someone who grew up in New England, in Manchester, New Hampshire, a state that today has zero federally recognized tribes, and yet there are still indigenous people there. And there's a way that New England has peculiar, profound forms of amnesia about its own regional past. A notion that maybe there was violence, but it was legitimate, and it was inevitable that things turned out the way they did. That's really problematic once you get into the historical sources and realize just how strategically indigenous people were trying to negotiate peace with colonial newcomers, trying to create treaties, trying to share this space, and yet at every turn they're experiencing pressures to give up their sovereignty, to give up their lands. And that aspect of the history has not been fully told. Mm. I think New England has a very hard time seeing itself as part of a settler colonial project. So by that, I mean a process of colonialism that attempts to continuously displace indigenous populations and take over their lands. That is not a narrative that functions really well in popular understandings of New England history. When people hear the Thanksgiving story, they think of this kind of amicable set of relations and don't realize just how tense things were and just how invested in trying to maintain peace Native communities were.
I mean, the dominant narrative is one more of enlightened arrivals to these shores, right? How analogous is this in terms of how we ought to be remembering the complexity and the various perspectives and the story from the Native perspective? I mean, how analogous is that to, you know, other struggles that we're having in this country about memorialization, if I can say use that term?
Right. I've been very interested to follow discussions, debates, protests around Black Lives Matter, Confederate memorials. And I'm grateful to activists who have brought to public attention in a really sharp way that American histories of race and politics around race are still very much contested. I think looking at the Northeast, the 17th century conflict known as King Philip's War, invites us to reconsider the utter centrality of indigenous people and indigenous sovereign nations to this region. They have never been marginal players. They have never been people who simply walked off stage at a certain point. They are still here. They are still sovereign. And they are telling their own histories. And yet those histories have often been treated as not trustworthy or ephemeral in some way. And I think that people who work in the field of history need to undergo a real change in the methods they use, the ethics they use, in thinking about who tells these stories.
Well, it sounds like we need some basic changes to history textbooks in schools as well.
I see curriculum actually in grade school, in high school, as really integral to helping these interventions and these alternate understandings gain some traction, because young people, including the ones who I teach in my college classrooms, are the ones who are going to bring about these changes.
Yeah. Well, the new book is Memory Lands, King Philip's War and the Place of Violence in the Northeast. It's by Christine DeLucia. She's an assistant professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. This has been a really interesting and enlightening conversation, Christine. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thanks for taking the time.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.